This Week with George Stephanopoulos starts right now.
Defining moment.
The House will be in order.
After months of delay, a rare coalition approves billions in aid for America's allies.
A bipartisan coalition of Democrats and Republicans has risen up.
The House has worked its will. These are not normal times here in the House or around the world.
A big win for the Speaker of the House, one that may cost him his job.
Mike Johnson's a lame duck. He is not going to lead us into the next Congress.
This morning, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chair Michael McCaul and Congressman Ro Khanna join us, plus our powerhouse roundtable. Supreme warning.
The political system seems hopelessly divided. The court seems to reflect that division.
It's a very complex institution.
Retired Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer as the court once again takes center stage in a presidential election. And
at the end of the day, do you feel like this is the most important thing you can do to fight climate change?
As Earth Week kicks off, Mary Alice Parks speaks with the environmental advocates fighting climate change at the ballot box. Part of our ABC News special series, The Power of Us.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, Jonathan Karl.
Good morning. Welcome to This Week. This weekend, we saw a rare outbreak of bipartisanship in what had seemed to be a hopelessly dysfunctional Congress. Just maybe the dawn of a new day for the House of Representatives, or it might have been a final act of yet another Republican speaker destined to be brought down by hardliners in his own party. Here's what we know. After months of delay, the House overwhelmingly approved billions of dollars in funding for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The vote on Ukraine funding was lopsided, a resounding show of support for Volodymyr Zelensky's efforts to defend his nation from Russia's aggression. But look more closely at the vote. Look at how Republicans voted. Just 101 Republicans voted yes. 112 voted no. That's a majority of House Republicans voting against support for Ukraine, a defining moment for the Republican Party, and a screaming indicator that the party of Reagan and the hawks who followed him is a distant memory. This is Trump's party, not Reagan's. It's a party that has fully embraced Trump's vision of America first. And while that is Trump's slogan, it was also the slogan of the isolationist Republicans who nearly a century ago opposed America's support for Great Britain in the beginning of World War II. Yesterday's vote was also a defining moment for Speaker of the House Mike Johnson. He did his job. He allowed the House to work its will. But he had to stand up to many in his own party to do so. Minutes after the vote, President Zelensky took note of the man who made it possible, posting on X, quote, "I am grateful to the United States House of Representatives, both parties, and personally, Speaker Mike Johnson, for the decision that keeps history on the right track." Speaker Johnson had to rely on Democrats to make it happen. And as he now faces a challenge to his leadership, Mike Johnson will almost certainly need to rely on Democrats to survive as Speaker, a fact that could radically change the power dynamics in Congress. So we begin this morning with ABC's Selena Wang on Capitol Hill. Good morning, Selena.
Hey, good morning, John. This is a defining moment for Speaker Johnson. After months of delay, the House has finally passed $95 billion in aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. But Johnson, he took enormous risks to get this done, defying the far-right wing of his party. But his job is safe, at least for now.
I think we did our work here, and I think history will judge it well.
For weeks, Marjorie Taylor Greene threatened to force a vote to remove Mike Johnson as Speaker of the House if he dared to allow a vote on military aid for Ukraine. But now that the vote has happened, Green still has not pulled the trigger, at least not yet.
I'm actually going to let my colleagues go home and hear from their constituents.
Now she'll have to wait until the House is back in session at the end of the month.
There is more support. It's growing. I've said from the beginning I'm going to be responsible with this. I support my majority. I support the majority next time. I do not support Mike Johnson.
So far, only two other House Republicans have signaled they backed Green's potential motion to vacate Johnson as Speaker. But with the razor-thin Republican majority, that could be enough to oust the Speaker. but Johnson says he doesn't care because support for Ukraine is more important than his job.
To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. My son is going to begin in the Naval Academy this fall. This is a live fire exercise for me, as it is so many American families. This is not a game. It's not a joke. We can't play politics with this. We have to do the right thing.
Johnson's support for Ukraine has won him some unlikely allies, Democrats who could help him save his job.
Traditional conservatives led by Speaker Mike Johnson have risen to the occasion.
You think you can trust the speaker?
Well, so far it looks that way.
Republican hardliners are outraged by Johnson's turnaround. For months, he had said any aid to Ukraine should be tied to funding for U.S. border security, despite recently rejecting a bipartisan border deal that former President Trump opposed.
We're worried about America's border. He seems to be more worried about Ukraine.
And Republican hardliners are even angrier that Johnson reached out to Democrats to get this done.
I'm concerned that the speaker's cut a deal with the Democrats to fund foreign wars.
I'm very disappointed, and I've told Speaker Johnson that personally. I've continued to see capitulation and an unwillingness to even fight.
Johnson says he's not worried about the threats.
I don't walk around this building being worried about a motion to vacate. I have to do my job.
Johnson may need Democrats to keep his job, and so far, at least some say they will.
I will vote to keep Johnson as Speaker.
I think that there will be Democrats who are happy to support him if he wants it.
In addition to aid to Ukraine, the House also passed $26 billion in aid to Israel. In the end, 37 Democrats voted against that. So now this package of bills, it heads over to the Senate, where they're expected to vote on this on Tuesday. And for his part, President Biden, he thanked the House for getting this done, saying that this sends a powerful message to the world about American leadership. John?
Thank you, Selena. I'm joined now by the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Congressman Michael McCaul. So let me ask you, Congressman, at the end, the vote was overwhelming, particularly on Ukraine,
right?
On all of these bills. Why did it have to be so difficult? Why did it take months to happen?
Well, I think, you know, the motion to vacate McCarthy, which is a rarely used tool, only twice in the history of Congress, right? And the threat of the motion to vacate kept this from coming to the floor in a timely basis. I have to say, watching your piece, I am so proud the Speaker, Mike Johnson. He went through a transformation. At the end of the day, profile and courage is putting the nation above yourself. And that's what he did. He said at the end of the day, I'm going to be on the right side of history, irrespective of my job. And I think that was what I admired so much.
It was a transformation. I mean, he had initially said no Ukraine funding until we take care of the border. He was with a lot, you know, basically what the radicals are saying. How do you explain that transformation? What made Johnson become the steadfast guy on this? As you said, the profile and courage.
I think he tried to do what the Freedom Caucus wanted him to do. It wasn't going to work in the Senate or the White House. At the end of the day, we were running out of time. Ukraine's getting ready to fall. And I think the briefings that he got in the classified space, the advice he got from people like me and Mike Turner, House Intelligence, Armed Services, I think talking to world leaders, he became the man that went from a district in Louisiana to the Speaker of the United States to also someone who had to look at the entire world and had to carry the burden of that and make the right decision. And his son's going to Annapolis. He is smart. He knows what's at stake here. If we surrender in Ukraine like we did in Afghanistan, America will be weaker, not stronger.
It's fascinating. He really was the one guy that could either make it happen or not happen. Is his job now in jeopardy?
I tell you what, he's got my support, and he has a lot of... I think the stock of Mike Johnson's gone way up. I think the respect for him's gone way up because he did the right thing irrespective of his job. That garnered a lot of respect, and also from the Democrat side. Now, that's not what you normally want. But I do think...
What's not what you normally want? Well, to rely on Democrats.
To have to do that, right? Yeah. It shows you that we're in a bipartisan era in some strange way where Democrats would be able to back a speaker on the other side of the aisle and not have him vacated out of the chair. But I think I think he's in good shape. I really do.
I mean, you already have enough Republicans to force the, you only need, takes one to force the vote, and you already have enough to remove him if it were only Republicans. So it looks like he's going to need to rely on Democrats to remain Speaker of the House. How does that change the dynamic? I mean,
well, I think they're also,
do we now have a coalition government in the House?
Well, I don't know. Maybe some people like that. I mean, yeah. there are those in my party. Look, the motion to vacate has only been used twice in history. Once Joe Cannon used it against himself to keep his position, and then McCarthy. When the motion to vacate is threatened every week in the Congress, that is being abused. And I think we need to fix that. That is a tool that's being abused by a minority when the majority of my conference don't agree with them. And they use that because they think that gives them power. And it does if they have a gun to the speaker's head every day. And so I think that's something that we'll be looking at.
I mean, when you heard the way Johnson was talking about this moment in history, whether or not we support Ukraine, the warning that if we don't, if Putin succeeds there, he moves through Europe potentially. It's certainly what particularly the Eastern Europeans worry about. You've made that case. Why is it that a majority of Republicans in the House voted against supporting Ukraine?
I think they bought into this notion that it's an either-or proposition. You can't secure the border. You can't support Ukraine without the border. We can do both. We're a great nation. Now, we are stuck in a political issue here. But, you know, America's back, and we have our allies back now. And the people, you know, in Israel and in Ukraine and in Taiwan and our NATO allies now know that America is back, that we're leading the free world like Ronald Reagan did. And, you know, Reagan brought down the Soviet Union, for God's sakes. The eyes of the world are watching, and our adversaries are watching, and history is watching. And that's what I kept telling my colleagues. Do you want to be a Chamberlain or a Churchill? Because that is the moment in time that we are at.
Well, one of your colleagues who agrees with you on this, Dan Crenshaw, said that looking at his colleagues that don't support this, fellow Republicans, it's, I'm guessing the reasoning is they want Russia to win so badly they're willing to oust the speaker over it. I mean, how is it that we have the party of Reagan, or formerly the party of Reagan, acting as if they want Russia to succeed in Ukraine?
I grew up in the Cold War, and I see it, I see the whole thing differently. And I think if we surrender in Ukraine like we did in Afghanistan, which was a debacle, is the United States of America going to be stronger or weaker? I would say weaker. And then Putin will invade Moldova. That's not Article 5. Georgia, he'll threaten the Baltics. And the United States is already, we can't shrink from this responsibility. You know, I quoted Churchill yesterday, the gathering storm. He talked about how it was unnecessary war. He saw the Axis of Evil and Hitler coming to power. But then he says to Roosevelt, this is an unnecessary war that could have been stopped. My dad was in that war. Just think if we could have stopped Hitler at Poland, how much blood and treasure we could have prevented. I think we're at the same moment in history now.
So where's Trump on this? I mean, we saw when he met with Viktor Orban of Turkey, Orban came out and said, Trump said not a penny more for Ukraine. Where's the real leader of your party on this?
If you read through the tea leaves, he has not come out and condemned a vote for Ukraine. What he said, it wouldn't happen if I had been president. He likes the idea of the loan program. You're going to hear Lindsey Graham talk today on Sunday. We've been talking to him about this loan program, and Mike Johnson has too. He likes the idea that it's not just a giveaway, but a loan program like the EU has for Ukraine. And so I think what he wants is for a lifeline to be given to Ukraine so that when he gets into office, in his thinking, that he can then negotiate and save it.
Well, it's a loan program that can be forgiven. Congressman McCaul, Chairman McCaul, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, John. Thanks for
appreciate it. Coming up, we'll ask Congressman Ro Khanna how Democrats are responding to Speaker Johnson's moves and whether they'll help him stay in power. We're back in just 2 minutes.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
After a busy and dramatic day on Capitol Hill, I'm joined now by Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna of California. Congressman Khanna, does Speaker Johnson deserve credit for how this played out?
He does. Look, we came into Congress together, and he always cared about civility. He actually led the civility pledge.
That's right. Yeah.
We had one issue, which was give individual votes. Don't lump things together. And I give him credit for doing this. I would actually vote to table any motion to vacate him. You know, Chairman McCaul quoted Churchill. One of the things Churchill said is that America always exhausted every wrong option until doing the right thing. Yeah. And this shows that American democracy still is very strong.
Okay, you just said something significant. You said you would oppose the motion to vacate. In other words, you will protect Speaker Johnson's job if Marjorie Taylor Greene and the others go through with their threat to try to remove him.
I would, through the end of the term. I expect Speaker Pelosi, Jeffers will be there in 2025. But look, and I'm a progressive Democrat, and I think you would have a few progressive Democrats doing that. And I disagree with Speaker Johnson on many issues, and I've been very critical of him. But he did the right thing here, and he deserves to keep his job till the end of this term.
Now, would you and fellow Democrats who will protect him at this moment ask for anything in return? I mean, do we effectively have... You heard me ask Congressman McCaul, a coalition government in the House?
I'll leave the negotiations to Speaker Jeffries, but yeah. I don't think everything in politics needs to be transactional. I think here you have Speaker Johnson, who not only put this up for a vote, but he also separated the bills, which I thought was courageous. He let people vote their conscience on Taiwan, on the offensive aid to Israel, on Ukraine, and I give him credit for that.
Now, you were one of the 37 who voted against the funding for Israel. Tell me more. Tell me why. I mean, why, and was that a high number or a low number in your view?
It was a high number. It was a hard vote. I mean, this was a stance against a blank check to Netanyahu and offensive weapons unconditionally while he's talking about going into Rafah when we know more women and children are going to die. And the reason that you had people like Jamie Raskin, Lloyd Doggett, myself, who have voted for Israel aid year after year and voted for Iron Dome, take this stand, is that we wanted to make it clear that there has to be a change in strategy and no more famine and suffering in Gaza.
I'm sure you saw the report in the Wall Street Journal on Friday that the Biden administration, is considering $1 billion arms deal with Israel. Are you concerned about how Biden is handling this?
I am, in terms of, I'm glad that he's moving in the rhetoric, but we can't be shipping offensive weapons when Netanyahu, on his own terms, is defying the president's State Department, defying the president's Secretary of Defense, and we know that thousands of people are going to die. And by the way, John, we know that Israel is still using the 2022 authorization and appropriation for Iron Dome, which I voted for, and many of the 37 who voted no voted for that funding. The money yesterday is not going to be used for another 2.5 years. So why are we giving this unconditionally to Netanyahu when the entire world is saying that there's famine there, that we need a new strategy, that we need a release of the hostages and peace?
So have you given this message to the White House?
They know. they've heard from many, many of us. But it's not just progressive Democrats. I mean, and we need an architecture for peace in the Middle East. I mean, look, Iran's attacks were totally unjustified. I voted to condemn them. But the reality is, until we have a security cooperation effort, a diplomatic architecture in the Middle East with Iran, with Saudi Arabia, with Israel, you're never going to get peace. And we're not going to be able to do what Lindsey Graham wants, which is blow Iran off the map. So what is the alternative? How are we going to get diplomacy and peace? That's where President Biden should be leading, as President Obama did.
I mean, given the Iran attack, attempted attack on Israel, I mean, it was, for the most part, unsuccessful. But, I mean, how do you not support Israel in terms of defense aid at a time when the Iranians, you know, have done something they have never done before, which is try to directly attack the Israelis, directly from Iran to Israel?
You absolutely do, and I supported Iron Dome funding. Yeah. We would have voted for a... We tried. Dan Kildee introduced an amendment saying, let's just make this about Iron Dome and David's sling in Arrow 3. That amendment wasn't ruled in order. Many of us have voted for all the defensive aid. I'd still support it, and I'd support the United States using the interceptors to knock anything down against Iran. But what we need is to figure out how we de-escalate, not give them offensive weapons, to now go into Hezbollah to expand the war. And by the way, John, look, I'm for the labor tradition from Ben-Gurion to Golda Meir to Rabin to Perez to Barak. I'm not for Begin to Sharon to Netanyahu. And what you've done is given a far-right Israeli government a carte blanche right now.
And before you go, there was also the vote on TikTok that was part of this. I know you have opposed efforts to force the sale of TikTok with the threat of a ban. But now it looks like if TikTok is not sold within a year, this bill becomes law, that ByteDance has to either, you know, if it doesn't sell, it's banned in the United States.
I don't think it's going to pass First Amendment scrutiny because I think there are less restrictive alternatives. We could have made it a crime to transfer Americans' data to an adversarial foreign nation or foreign state interference. But to just ban 170 million Americans who are engaged in speech and livelihood, the federal judge in Montana struck it down. The judges struck it down when Trump tried this. I doubt it survives scrutiny in the Supreme Court.
All right, Congressman Ro Khanna, thank you for joining us
this
week. The Powerhouse Roundtable is standing by, ready to break down what happens next for Speaker Johnson and how Donald Trump's first criminal trial could impact the 2024 race. We'll be right back.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Under my predecessor, who's busy right now, Pennsylvania lost 275,000 jobs.
I'm supposed to be in New Hampshire. I'm supposed to be in Georgia. I'm supposed to be in North Carolina, South Carolina. I'm supposed to be in a lot of different places campaigning. But I've been here all day on a trial that really is a very unfair trial.
President Biden and former President Trump on how his criminal trial is impacting his campaign. Let's bring in the Powerhouse Roundtable. We have former DNC Chair Donna Brazile, former RNC Chair and Trump White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, ABC News Senior White House Correspondent Selena Wang is back with us, and Politico Senior Columnist Jonathan Martin. Jay Martin, let me start right with where we were with McCall. This was a transformation that we saw from Speaker of the House Johnson. What do you think drove it? How did he suddenly become this force willing to lose his job for the sake of something he opposed just 6 months ago?
I think it was a combination of intel briefings with folks who work for groups with acronyms that run their organizations.
CIA, DNI,
exactly.
You know, whatever.
Folks with four stars on their shoulders, foreign leaders. I think it was also, frankly, the call of history, him recognizing that he was in a providential moment. And then lastly, politics. He was trying to save face, John. The fact is, if he hadn't have moved this bill the way he did, there was going to be an effort to bring it to the floor directly through a procedure that would have effectively brought the Senate bill up for a vote, gone around him. And so he wanted to save face. And he you know, cut the bill up like he did, and he added that TikTok ban, which is, I think, more consequential than what would have happened if it was just the Senate bill.
Does he lose his job?
So, look, I think right now he obviously is going to face a challenge, But two things. I think the Democrats are going to rally to him because otherwise they'd look small and they would not look like they were answering history's call.
Yeah.
But also, something else is important. I think Trump will stand with him at least for now, not because Trump has this sort of great sense of altruism, but because of Trump's politics, John. He doesn't want the distraction and the mess. Trump does not want more drama. He has plenty on his own.
All right, so Donna, we heard Ro Khanna say that he will vote to protect the Republican Speaker of the House's job. Is that what we're going to see in the House? Are we going to see a lot of that?
Well, it all depends. Look, I think the Speaker will have to reach out to Hakeem Jeffries and others, like he did over the last couple of days, to be able to save his job. But look, I have to say this. I'm a Louisianian. I'm always proud when Louisiana people come through, especially someone with LSU ties. But he's no moderate. He's a MAGA Republican. We all know that. We know what he stands for. He resisted this. He said at first, we will not pass this foreign aid package until we get the appropriation bills through, until we get the FISA. He kept putting conditions. At the end of the day, I agree with Jamar. He decided to go with history and to be the soul who understood what's at stake in protecting Ukraine, protecting our allies in the Middle East, as well as in the Indo-Pacific region. So he did the right thing.
So, Ryan, so let me ask you something about something that Newt Gingrich, a former Speaker of the House from days long gone by, said about the mess unfolding. He said the demons that Matt Gaetz, unleashed by going after Kevin McCarthy are still out there. You can't govern by shooting yourself in the head every day. I guess that's probably correct, but are the Republicans going to be effectively shooting themselves in the head?
No, I don't think so, because obviously I think Speaker Johnson and his leadership prevailed. And what he did was he also listened to his colleagues this week for hours. He allowed amendments on the floor. And I think he made it pretty clear, as has been just said, that, you know, it's one thing to govern through media clicks, small dollar donations, podcasts, and getting famous as a representative. It's another thing when you sit down in intel hearings and discussions, and you really hear the truth, and you listen to recordings, and you know what the truth is, and you feel the weight of
our country. Ukraine may fall if this doesn't pass.
And where we're going. And the last thing, though, is Donald Trump also laid off.
Yeah.
Because he knows also the intelligence, number one. Number two, as was said, nobody in the Republican Party wants to look so stupid as to have yet another leadership fight with no pathway in sight.
I've got to fact check you there, because there are many Republicans
already. There's a few. But you know, there's always going to be a few that want that want to get this kind of attention. But Trump is doing very well. And trust in the economy poll came out. He was plus 22 in Georgia, plus 12 in Michigan. And why would he or any Republican want to create this kind of mess?
Selena, I saw you up there all week on the Hill, running after those that were gunning for Johnson and also with Johnson himself. What is your sense? I mean, he seems confident that his job is not at risk. Is that a real confidence?
And every time he's asked about it, including when I did, he just laughs it off and says, I need to do my job. I can't be focused on this motion to vacate every day. But I think Ryan's makes a really good point, which is when I was talking to a lot of these more moderate members of the Republican House, they said, look, I'm very angry at Johnson. I'm extremely disappointed in him. But it makes us, the Republican Party, look bad if we throw this House into chaos once again. So they were saying they were not for what Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing. And so far, let's be real, she's been all bark, no bite. We haven't seen any motion yet. So far, Johnson has managed to use some congressional jujitsu to get these bills across the finish line. And so far, he's still kept his gavel.
And the Democrats seem serious about actually not allowing Marjorie Taylor Greene to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they understand that they want to get some stuff done, and they're going to look like adults in the room if she ends up doing it and they end up coming in to save him. So there's really, even if there was a motion to vacate, it's not necessarily going to be successful.
You know, Ryan, your former colleague in the White House, Steve Bannon, told me this morning, Mike Johnson's going down.
Well,
when? What year?
Yeah, there's no year. We'll see. But I do think that as we're listening to this, the Democrats do need to be careful. I mean, they need to keep quiet as far as their willingness to jump up and down and save Speaker Johnson. Because the more Democrats come out and say, I'm going to protect Speaker Johnson, the more
the opposition
say, wait a second.
Well, we're not going to be silent. Because we're standing up for the American people. We want a budget that works for everybody. We want a country that functions. We want to, you know, we want to protect America's dignity
by
in the world.
Johnson,
he's the Speaker of the House, and while he is elected by the majority of Republicans, he's a constitutional officer. So it's not about the individual, it's about the Constitution and an officer of the nation.
If Democrats continue, if this effort goes forward, and Johnson is there because there were Democrats that refused to go along with the effort to oust him, is there going to be a price that the Democrats, you know, this is politics after all, do Democrats want to get something in return for supporting Johnson? This is my question about a coalition government.
I'm not in Hakeem's office every day or anyone else in the House leadership, but as a former Hill staffer, I would hope that the Democrats would put the interest of the country. This is a very important, as the president often says, it's an inflection point for the nation. So the Democrats must do what is in the best interest of the nation and then figure out what's in the best interest of our chances 197 days from now.
I think the agenda for the rest of this calendar year in the Congress is pretty darn thin. They're not bringing up the Civil Rights Act of 1964 here, okay? We're talking about, like, reauthorizing
the government's funding, at least.
Reauthorizing the FAA, keeping the lights open in the government. Look, I think the only way that Democrats would change their mind and move on Johnson is if Johnson was to move to impeach Biden.
Yep.
Okay, because that, I think, would effectively break the tacit bargain. I don't see that happening. And if this is just sort of keeping the government open until November, I think Johnson's job is safe because of those Democrats. Now, next year, I think, who knows, right?
All right, I want to turn to the other big story this week, Trump in court, and I want to play a little something that he had to say outside of the courtroom this week.
It's a shame. And I'm sitting here for days now, from morning till night, in that freezing room, freezing. Everybody was freezing in there.
Everybody's freezing in there. I mean, he's stuck in a room where he can't even control the thermostat.
50%.
You've seen that Donald Trump before. That's an irritated
Donald
Trump.
How cold is he, Ryan?
50% of the American people think that this case is political. That's a big number. Donald Trump, of all people, he's turning himself into a victim. And that's an amazing thing. And he's doing it. And this is the perfect case to do it. And this is classic Donald Trump. And whether it be not being able to go to Barron's high school graduation, whether it be not being able to go to the Supreme Court hearing this week, or whether it be freezing in the courtroom.
Yeah,
but this is all part of the narrative. It's all part of the movie script moving forward. And he's playing it.
And that's why he's tried to delay this trial 10 times, because it's meaningless. It doesn't matter. You know what matters? He is sitting in a courtroom every day while Joe Biden is gone from your home state to Pennsylvania, down to Florida this week, because the Biden campaign will take every opportunity
to show and it's
that
not working.
He is working for
it's
the American
working.
People.
He's still behind. He's still behind.
No, I was going to say, but does his message from the courtroom to make himself a victim, does that resonate with anyone outside of who already supports him?
I think that's marginalizes with independence whatever outcome happens with this case. In 2016... it was 24/7, lousy press, good press, everything in between Donald Trump. If you look at the press, 90% of it's about Trump. And he went through the last 3 weeks with 5 rallies a day and turned out one of the biggest upsets in modern history. When it's all about Trump, he's winning.
I actually disagree with that.
538 average has shown a bit of a...
I think the opposite's true. I think if the election's about
Biden...
If the election's about Biden, Trump's going to win. I think if the election's about Biden's got a lot better chance. And right now, Biden's problem is this election's about Joe Biden.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is the challenge, right?
Those are the kind of numbers that make a Biden very nervous. So,
and
how does the White House
deal... Michigan's the most ominous number there.
How does the White House deal with the fact that you know, Trump is stuck? You know, he's got the world's attention, certainly.
He's on trial. He's still winning.
I think they're loving it, actually, because... you haven't seen them directly tackle his legal issues head on. You've seen veiled swipes from the president throughout this week. But for them, for the Biden campaign, they believe to have the former president, the GOP frontrunner, sitting in court defending himself against criminal charges for covering up this massive scandal, they think that speaks for himself. And you've seen the president, he did some half a dozen campaign stops in Pennsylvania. He's going to be in Florida this week, hammering home the issue of abortion, which is significant because as a Catholic, he's been kind of uncomfortable on that and has let Harris deal with it. But they think that all these issues they're hitting on the economy, on abortion, that's going to be that strong split screen they want with Trump, meanwhile,
but,
in court.
But Donna, those numbers have to just terrify.
You know, Jonathan, last
Democrats.
Week I had numbers that looked better than that. Every week when we see one number this way and one number that way, they're going to seesaw. But you know, here's the best part of this conversation. No, it's not that far down, because if you look that far down, then you will not see bottom. And I'm from the Mississippi River.
He's scraping,
know,
huh?
I know, no. You know, Joe Biden has to do a delicate dance in bringing back the Democratic family and the independents, especially suburban women. Yeah. And he is showing every day that he's bringing them back home. And when he bring them home, they will
all
turn
right.
out.
All the right. numbers aren't there yet, though.
Thank you all.
That's what
prayer. Got to move on, because up next, we have retired Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer joining me right here in our chambers in the studio. We'll be right back.
I'm here today to express the nation's gratitude to Justice Stephen Breyer for his remarkable career of public service and his clear-eyed commitment to making our country's laws work for its people.
I can't take this around in my job. People have come to accept this Constitution, and they've come to accept the importance of a rule of law.
That was President Biden and Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer speaking following Breyer's 2022 announcement that he was retiring. Justice Breyer is out with a new book titled Reading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism. And Justice Breyer joins me now right here in the studio. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
So let me get right at the thesis of the book. You make the case in this fascinating book, Sweeping History of the Supreme Court, that justices should consider the practical consequences of a decision, such as how those affected by the decision will react. How does that work in practice?
In practice, you do your best to figure out what's going to happen. When it's most likely to play a major role is when you look at the words of the Constitution and they don't tell you the answer. Look at the words of a statute. They don't tell you the answer. And so people forever, since Chief Justice Marshall in 18, whatever it was, and Holmes and Brandeis, the other, they say, look at, somebody wrote those words. They had a reason. And you're in trouble.
Because as you know, there's an argument that a justice has to stay within the four corners of what's written on that page.
Yes.
Let's look at, for instance, in the Dobbs decision, what Justice Alito wrote. We do not pretend to know how our political system or society will respond to today's decision overruling Roe and Casey. And even if we could foresee what will happen, we would have no authority to let that knowledge influence our decision.
Really?
Why is he wrong?
Really? Because, let me give you a very simple case. Yeah. You may know that if you have a person has a child who's handicapped, the school board has to give that child a good education. And if the mother or father think not, they can bring a lawsuit. And if they win that lawsuit, the statute says they're entitled to their costs. Now, that was the case.
Okay? Yeah.
Costs. Does cost include the cost of an educational expert, $29,000? Or does it just mean legal costs? Mm-hmm. So I say, here, why don't you try this, Mr. Textualist? Mm-hmm. Say it loud. Costs. Yeah. Now, do you know the answer? Yeah. Say it twice. Cost, cost. Three times. Cost, cost, cost. Doesn't tell you. So the other things that judges have always looked to, too. Who wrote those words and what did they have in mind? What was Congress trying to do? What are the consequences if you go one way rather than another way? Mm-hmm. How does it fit into a set of values that begins with the Constitution? Judges have always done that kind of thing. And it is part of the role of interpreting a statute or the Constitution.
So let me ask you, though, as a justice, when you're going through a high-profile, controversial case, are you hearing the noise outside? I mean, I guess literally the protests outside the court, but more broadly, are you gauging and thinking about how the world is going to react, how the country is going to react to your decision?
Yes, I would say that's in your mind.
And how? How do you do that? Are you, how?
And when you say, does that lead to your deciding X rather than not X?
Yeah.
Well, I can never say never, but rarely. Paul Freund, professor, great professor of constitutional law, said that the role of politics in the courts, in any court, he says, no judge should or will be moved by the temperature of the day. But every judge will be aware of the climate of the season.
So what about our time now? The political system seems hopelessly divided. The court seems to reflect that division.
Hard to say. It's a very complex institution. And where I think the politics that I've seen, I've not seen politics in the court, and I've been a judge for 40 years. I've not seen...
You have not seen politics in the court?
Not politics in the sense in which I understood that word when I worked for Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, when he was a senator.
Yep.
And I worked there for a few years. Look, you get a phone call. Mayor of Worcester, same time.
Yeah.
Secretary of Defense, which call will Senator Kennedy take first?
Mayor of Worcester.
Of course, it's politics, of course, of course. I mean, politics was how popular is this, how unpopular is that? How are we going to get the Republicans to go along, possibly, or some Democrats too?
Yeah.
How do we get all the people to the Senate meetings? Where do you want to stand when you're running for election? And. That isn't there. That just isn't there.
So how important it was for the Supreme Court when they ruled on the Colorado case about whether or not Trump could be on the ballot, that was a unanimous decision?
How important was
it? Yeah.
Well, don't talk about that case because you'll know more about it than me because that's after I left the court. But the in general, that is a very interesting question for me because it's very tempting once you've written a dissent, even from a denial for a refusal to hear a case.
Yeah.
You've written the dissent, your real audience is the other judges. Mm-hmm. But if you fail at that, well, you've written it, why not let the country have the virtue of seeing your, no, said Holmes.
Yeah.
No, said Taft. And Taft said, it's just ego. So I always thought, well, it doesn't hurt to publish these things. It puts out another point of view. It shows people, which they would believe anyway, that not everybody is in agreement. But there's also something to be said to try to keep down the extent to which you publicly reveal the disagreement.
Would the justices ever do the kind of horse trading we see in Congress? I mean, I don't mean to be crass about this, but you have two cases before the court that could determine the presidential election, decide one, it looks better for Donald Trump, the ballot access issue. One, absolute immunity that doesn't serve his purposes, and they both come out, send the country a message.
I mean, look, it may be that you could find a compromise in the conference or a way of approaching things in the conference that will, in fact, solve a number of problems, and that could be one of the problems.
It would be a very powerful message to the country to see two 9-0 decisions
that can't
be broken down into straight political lines.
The second, Sandra O'Connor used to say this, the first unwritten rule is nobody speaks twice till everyone speaks once. Second unwritten rule, tomorrow is another day.
Yeah.
You and I were the greatest of allies on case one. Case two, we're absolutely at loggerheads. So,
but they are looking to how the country is gonna receive these decisions.
Be careful in saying that. I want to say no. I want to say no, but I can't say no, never. Yeah. I mean, you're up there in that. You're up there in that building, which I can see a picture of down here. And in that building, you are making decisions that will affect people. Of course, knowing that a lot of people are going to read a case leads me to write, if it's my opinion to write, use certain language that is easy to understand and spend a lot of time trying to explain why.
And you don't want to contribute to the political divide in the country.
No. Of course not. But of course not. But you're looking for an easy answer, when I'm not being coy and saying, no, there aren't easy answers.
All right, Justice Stephen Breyer, thank you for being right here in the studio on This Week. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you.
Coming up, Mary Alice Parks kicks off Earth Week with the ABC series, The Power of Us. We'll be right back. As we mark Earth Day tomorrow, ABC News White House correspondent Mary Alice Parks travels to battleground Pennsylvania to report on the effort to turn out voters who care about climate change. It kicks off our network-wide series, The Power of Us, covering emerging solutions for our changing world.
Emily Church is a biologist turned activist.
I'm aiming for around 80 today.
Knocking on doors in Pittsburgh, she tells me she used to spend time pushing lawmakers on climate change, but lawmakers told her voters didn't care.
The people who prioritize climate and the environment need to show up. If the voter comes to the door, basically just follow the script.
The Environmental Voter Project is targeting very specific voters, environmentally conscious citizens, often young people and people of color, who rarely head to the polls.
Of all the ways to work on climate change, why this?
People who vote are who politicians pay attention to, and so they make the decisions.
And that's our biggest problem in the climate movement right now. We don't have enough voting power.
The group's founder, Nathaniel Stinnett, says they've had some success.
We've sometimes increased turnout as much as 1.8 percentage points in general elections, 3.6 points in primaries, and 5.7 points in local elections.
Okay, if I'm being honest, that doesn't sound like a lot.
Ask Donald Trump how big a deal 1.8% is in Pennsylvania, and I'll tell you.
The group is nonpartisan, though acknowledges it's almost exclusively Democrats right now working to address climate change. They hope they can push Republicans to come to the table, too.
We want to scare the bejesus out of as many politicians as possible, no matter what side of the aisle they're on, until they think, you know what, the only way I can win elections is if I start recognizing the biggest crisis that humanity faces.
But that's no easy task. Across the board this election, registered voters list immigration, the economy, abortion, and democracy as their top issues, with climate change not even making the top 10. Partisan and generational divides at play.
Basically, the younger the voter, the more they're likely to prioritize climate change as a voting issue. And yeah, that is going to be a reality that Republicans are going to need to grapple with eventually.
In November, the choice before voters is stark. But many Democrats worry young progressives might still stay home, despite the Biden administration investing billions to fight climate change.
What do you say to those young voters who argue he hasn't done enough?
Well, the fact is, President Biden has done more to address climate change than any president in U.S. history. And there's a lot more to be done. Scientists have said that we still can avoid the worst of the worst of the climate crisis, but what we do in these next few years is essential.
Nathaniel says big policy matters, and too often Americans have been told to focus on their own small habits.
Hey, don't pay attention to that coal-fired power plant back there. Instead, it's all your fault for having a plastic water bottle in your hand. And we bought it. When in truth, it is far more of a political and a systemic problem that needs political and systemic solutions.
It's an uphill battle, but for Emily, finding and activating these new voters is worth the fight.
The science is very clear, so we know what we need to do. It's just a matter of getting it done.
For This Week, Mary Alice Parks, ABC News, Pittsburgh.
Our thanks to Mary Alice, and be sure to catch more of the Power of Us series across ABC News this week. Thank you for sharing part of your Sunday with us. Have a great day.